Hey, how you doing, everybody? Welcome to the Ron Smith Radio Show. Hello, Ryan. It's good to see you've had some sleep, man. Last Friday, you were looking a little bleary-eyed. It was hard, really, to tell the difference from your normal demeanor, but I could tell because I'm really closely attuned to you, as you know. This afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk with Peter Moskos, who has become a regular guest on the show. I mean, it's an amazing thing. I don't know how this has happened. He's just ingratiated himself that much. But Peter Moskos is assistant professor of law, police science, and criminal justice administration at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And if he gets all of that on his business card, man, it's got to be a big card. But the key is he's a former Baltimore City police officer as well, and he has a book out, Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. And since this is a Baltimore radio station, and, you know, we're always reading about and observing the actions and the interactions of Baltimore City Police and the areas that they patrol and police, we're very interested in his book. And so Peter joins us because, I don't know, what are you passing through? What?
I was at a crab fest last night. Every year I don't miss it at St. Francis of Assisi,
right?
My sergeant's church. And I think we're trying to figure it out. I may have missed a year or two, but I think it's my ninth crab fest there. And I bring more and more people from New York because we don't have crabs up there.
How many did you bring down?
My wife and four friends. So there were six of us there.
Did they enjoy it?
Oh, they loved it. And it's a long way to drive for some steamed crabs. I spent the night, but they all went right back, and they left happy.
Oh, my goodness. You know, we've done this before, so it's like, let me ask you this, okay? Not everybody has reacted favorably to your dissection of the Baltimore Police Department and the way it works. Is that fair enough to say?
Sort of. The people who have acted negatively haven't read it and don't know my dissection. They just react negatively to me, which bothers me.
Because you're an egghead.
Exactly. Because what would I know? I was only here for a little. But they have. The point is, my book is not for police officers. They know more than I do. I admit that. If you've just retired after 20, 30 years on the force, write your own book. I'd love to read it. Mm-hmm. But this is my book. It's what I have to offer. It's not for police, though I think they'd enjoy reading it. It is for the public. It is for other academics to know and appreciate just what the patrol officers do, the hard-working men and women of the Baltimore Police Department. This is what I'm trying to get out, is that word. Spread the truth. I'm mm-hmm. trying to do my little part.
Yeah. And when we've had you on before, we've had calls from police officers, many of whom were supportive of your observations.
Oh, generally,
insofar as they understood them, you know.
So, yeah, I haven't heard anything negative. People have read the book. There is a certain former commissioner who I won't name who wasn't very pleased, mm-hmm. but it wasn't about me. That's about him, I suppose. From the police who have read it, they say, look, I don't agree with everything in the book. There's some details I might quibble with. I don't think drugs should be legal and regulated. Mm-hmm. But what you write is true. I appreciate your perspective. Overall, the support's been extremely favorable.
The key thing about your experience was that it was to have been a scholarly look at the Baltimore Police Department and the difficulties it confronts, its task, how it does its task. But it became more than that because commissioners changed, and the new commissioner said, you can do this. We'll give you access if you become a cop.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. There were some politics at the top, but I didn't know what were going on. In hindsight, though I don't view that man as my friend, in hindsight, he really helped me out because I wouldn't know what I do today. I wouldn't have the job I do today had I not been a police officer. That is an experience and access that it's been wonderful for me.
It was a good career move, as it turned out, even though it didn't look like one.
Exactly. Yeah. And I did. I mean, everyone who I worked with knew my plan. I wasn't doing this in secret. And I heard from a lot of people, look, if you can use this as a stepping stone to something better, more power to you. And it's not that I didn't take my job seriously when I was working here in Baltimore, but I did use it as a stepping stone to something better. I went back, I finished school, I got my PhD, and then I wrote this book. One of the complaints, and it's legitimate, is it is 7 years later now. And it just, that's how long it took me to write my book, unfortunately. I would love for my book to be dated. I would love for us to say, you know what, there is no more violence in Baltimore. Maybe murders will continue to go down. I would love to say my book of history. That's not the case yet, and certainly not for the patrol officer, the man or woman still out there answering the radio. That job hasn't changed.
No, no, and it's a very demanding one and a daunting one, and yet a lot of people who do it love it. Isn't that an interesting thing?
God bless them.
Were you surprised at that, by the
way?
No,
I was actually surprised at how many people do it and don't love it. Mm-hmm. After, it does grind you down. It's a rough job. It's a rough city. It's a rough bureaucratic organization, the BPD. There are lots of things that don't work well. Those who can pace themselves and after 33 years saying, you know what, this is the best job I ever have, and I'm sorry to be retiring, that they're wonderful officers. Mm-hmm.
Peter Mosco is our guest. His book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. And it's the way I looked at this book is it was two books in one. You know, it was about your personal experiences and your training, and we'll get into that, and then your experience as a cop on the beat. But it was also an indictment of the war on drugs, which is something that interests me as well. Peter Mosco's with us. His book is Cop in the Hood. In a review, Peter, in the Wall Street Journal by a police officer in California named Daniel Horan, he really was appreciative. You've read the review.
That was a great review for me. Got me a lot of press. So that's old books.
Yeah, exactly. And he was appreciative of the fact that you became not just an outsider, you know, studying something, because I guess they experience that quite often.
Academics love going in and telling, after 3 months of ride-along, telling cops what to do.
Well, when you made the decision, because if you're going to continue this, you had to become a police officer, I imagine that you had some apprehension about this. This wasn't exactly something that had been in your plans.
No, it wasn't in my plans. You know what it was? I looked around my police academy class of there were 50 of us in that academy classroom, and I said, you know, I may not be the best cop in here, but I know I'm not going to be the worst.
You figure if they can do it,
I can do it.
I can do it, and do it you did. Although, and I don't want to dwell on this, and I'm sure you don't either, but you found the training to be kind of disconnected from what you were going to find after the training, which would seem to me, upon reflection, that that's the ordinary course of things in most pursuits.
Yeah, but
you know, I mean, it's like
the stakes are higher in policing, and there have been a lot of changes since I went through the police academy, and I hope and assume they're for the better. I think they are for the better, but it's such an opportunity. You know, police don't get paid enough, but still, they're getting paid full salary for 6 months. This is the chance where you can actually do something productive, and so much of the academy is pushing people through. It's not a weed-out process like it should be. You know, I don't know. I can't give you an exact number, but you take any group of 50, the bottom 5 or 10% probably shouldn't be there. It's a lot easier to get rid of a police officer at that stage than it is after they have a year on the street and they got civil service protection.
Just off the top of my head, what I would guess is that it's hard enough to keep the ranks filled that the incentive is to make sure that you don't wash out a lot of people because you need them.
You need the numbers, and that's part of the problem of not paying police enough. But it's also people, look, the academy says it's not my job to fire people. It's my job to train them and my job to get them through, which on an individual level, that's correct. But there is a greater problem, which is pay them more. Why? But we try to do things on the cheap and then you get what you pay for. Mm-hmm. I mean, what to me is amazing is how good and hard most police officers are given the amount of money they make and the working conditions in the police department.
What was the greatest dislocation between the end of your training and what you observed, say, in your first weeks on the job in the Eastern District?
You can't train for real human emotion. To see abject poverty and to see bad parents raising kids in dirty homes. It's part of it's poverty. It's not just poverty. There's nothing about being poor that means you can't sweep your house. There's something else going on. And to be around a crime scene where someone's been killed and to deal with people, with the passion of real human emotion, mm-hmm. you can't role play that stuff. That is something that you do have to learn on the street. It would be nice if there was some more back and forth, where spend some time on the street, then go back to the... You could combine the two a bit better. But at least when I was there, that wasn't done.
Now, I imagine a lot of people start out as police officers, as you do in most professions, saying, by God, I'm going to have a chance to make a difference. You know, I'm going to approach this in a way that's going to be significant. It's going, you know, I'm going to transcend the institution, right? And yet that the institution is always much more powerful than the individual's will to be different from it.
And it's considered good for young police officers to have that attitude. It worries me a bit because You're not going to change the world. You might change some lives and you might do some good, which is a nice part about the job. How many other jobs can you save a life in? But you're not going to save the world. And if you go in with that attitude and you think it's all going to be excitement, there's a good chance you're going to get burnt out. If you go in saying, look, this is a job. I'm going to take it seriously. I'm going to do my best. But it's a job. It is not a life's calling. I think that's better over the course of 20 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. Matt in Westminster joins us. Peter Mosco's my guest. His book is Cop in the Hood. And Matt, you've read it, huh?
Yes. Hi, Ron. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Matt.
On your recommendation, I bought the book and just finished it. And I enjoyed the book. The insights into the policing were interesting, and I have to say I long have agreed with the idea of removing the profit margin from street drugs, and the drug element is the only way to work against the rampant crime. It's pretty bad out there, but unfortunately the profit margin for both the criminals as well as the, prison, police, lawyer conglomerate or whatever you want to call it.
A lot of people benefit from the status quo.
Yes, they do.
In this and in everything else, which is why I've always said the status quo is far more powerful than most people presume, because they'll look at the flaws of the status quo and they say, well, certainly it has to be understood that this has to be changed. But more powerful people benefit from things as they are than anything else. In other words, that's the strongest special interest collection you can find.
Yeah.
It's not a conspiracy, I always want to say. It's just simply like...
Well, yeah, it's just it's an ongoing enterprise is what it is, and basically people are doing what... they just end up getting jobs and making profit, and things are going along. Just have two words for you. Kurt Schmoke.
That's right. His
well, he unfortunately gave a bad word to the idea of harm reduction in Baltimore, which
right.
I think is... I'm not defending Kurt Schmoke himself, but I'm saying harm reduction is a good idea.
Right.
I'm for reducing harm. I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer, but it didn't work too well under him.
No, because politically, it was then, and it is still an untenable position to hold to publicly if you wish a career in politics.
And also, he thought he could reduce harm, I think, in the wrong way. The problem... I don't want... neighborhood full of addicts roaming the streets. I mean, police have to do something.
No, absolutely. I fully support law enforcement, and God knows, thank God you guys, you for the 18 months you did the job, and the other ones are out on the street every day. It's not a job that the rest of us regular civilians would be able to do, and we appreciate it. But as I say, a lot of the crime that's out there, I was on one of the grand juries in Anne Arundel County. It was the first one that had a drug kingpin prosecution. It was actually some kid from Crofton.
Wasn't the mayor of Berwyn, was it?
No, it was the kid from Crofton whose parents were psychologists that worked at NSA. This is years ago, and it was the first one that it was a marijuana thing, but it was absolutely ridiculous. Almost like a Keystone Cops thing for the criminal.
Matt, I've got to go.
Yep.
Was he found guilty?
Oh, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, okay,
thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye. We're visiting with Peter Mosco's, who is a Harvard-trained sociologist, a professor in New York at...
John Jay College.
Yeah, and teaching all sorts of stuff. And his experience as a Baltimore police officer, brief though it was, is just sets you apart from your colleagues. And some of them don't like that, isn't that right? Do I recall you telling me that?
No, I get along great with my colleagues, and there are some, because it's a somewhat unique college of criminal justice, there are other former police officers on the faculty there who have served longer time than me. There are, if you ask the average sociologist, whatever he or she thinks, they'll say, no, of course you don't have to actually do what you research. And the field is sort of built on that attitude.
But when you went back to Harvard, it was a different story.
Once I got back and I was still in one piece and things were getting done, then it was fine. But in the beginning, they were against the idea of me becoming a police officer. Harvard students aren't supposed to do that. Want to do it all the more.
Yes, indeed. Be a renegade. Here's Roger in Towson. Roger, go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. But I work in unemployment insurance. I've been doing this for many years. And a recurring problem we have with certain claimants who are incarcerated, and then when they go to jail, the jailer does not allow them to call their employer to notify them of their whereabouts and why they can't report to work. Consequently, they lose their job oftentimes. And they qualify for unemployment if it's considered a compelling reason and they can prove it. But I've always wondered why jailers do not allow people that are recently incarcerated to make that call, not only to their attorney and family, but also to their employer, so they can perhaps maintain their job.
I can't answer for the correctional officers, because there are a lot of bad things going on in jails and prisons that we don't see about, because it's behind bars. I will say, when I would lock people up, I would often, "You can't lock me up, I got a job." And I'd say, "Sir, I'm not locking you up for being unemployed. I'm locking you up for a crime." But occasionally you get a request and say, "Look, can you make this call for me to an employer?" Sometimes I had no problem with that. I mean, if they were polite and what, I would say, "Yeah, look, I'm locking you up because you committed a crime. I don't want you to get fired for it. That's your own business." But yeah, sometimes I did occasionally call an employer and say, Mr. Jones won't be coming to work today.
Usually you hear they say, well, they'll allow you to reverse the charges to the employer, but the employer doesn't know who it is, so they won't accept the call, or there's always some excuse. I think there should be some kind of fund or some way to allow, these rehabilitation is maintaining gainful employment, and this is one of the keys, I think.
Yeah, but you're speaking rationally as if there was some common sense to all these policies.
Yeah. Or to the crimes that were committed.
That's true.
I mean, people commit these crimes on impulse often, and there's prices to be paid. Yeah.
Well, oftentimes it's a domestic dispute or something, not a life and death situation.
Well, actually, domestic disputes are often life and death situations.
But leaving aside the criminal, as a taxpayer, I don't want that person to lose their job, because then they're going to go to the unemployment office.
Right, and they qualify oftentimes. They say, "Well, listen, my hands were tied. I couldn't call work, and my employer..."
Interesting. Yeah. All right. Roger, thanks very much. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, I was on the net a couple of days ago, and I ran across something that I'd been aware of a number of years back, but it's apparently still going on, at least in some places. And that is, and it certainly didn't apply to you, but they're cutting some folks off based on their IQ being too high and applying for the police force. Have you heard of anything like that?
There was one case, I think it was in Connecticut. There was one case where that happened. That is not normal. And that when that happened, so many police chiefs called that person up and said, "We would welcome you here." No, the police departments love smart police officers, and most police officers are quite smart. The problem isn't the IQ. You just have to understand that the job isn't going to be all fun and games or all excitement. That's I think we've got to go in. But no, that was one department. I'm sure that chief isn't working there anymore, whoever said we don't. But his point was simply, look, a lot of this job is drudgery, and you got to be ready for that. And that's true.
It is. By the way, there's a book written in the 70s by some fella that was working in Jacksonville called Signal Zero, which patterns after what you've done. And by the way, it's worth doing it's worth doing a lot to have people coming out of the academics and going into the police force. He did exactly what you did, and his attitudes about the police and what police do and what they're
See, there's nothing new under the sun.
You know, I don't know that book. I'll find it.
What is the name of it again, Captain Jim?
Signal Zero.
Signal Zero. Okay.
Signal Zero. And it's about a guy that worked from the south, and he went to...
We'll Google it. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah.
Take
right,
care.
Bye bye.
The Ron Smith Show. Peter Moskos is with us in studio talking about being a cop in the hood and writing a book by that title, His Year of Policing, Baltimore's Eastern District. You're welcome to join us at 410-467-WBAL. I'm Talk Show Man with you until 6 this evening. 410-467-WBAL, the phone number. And we're talking with Peter Moskos of John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He wrote Cop in the Hood, My Year of Policing, Baltimore's Eastern District. And you said in a piece in U.S. News and World Report just the other day, that drugs are bad, so let's legalize them. And of course, as I said, I viewed your book as being in two parts, your police experience and then railing against the current drug policies in this country. Is that an accurate
Someone's got to do it. That's a great description.
This sounds terrible to a lot of people. So succinctly tell us your argument as to why that should be
the policy. It
sounds terrible
because drugs are terrible, or some drugs are terrible. And I accept that. I'm not saying that heroin is a good drug. I'm saying war on drugs doesn't work. Prohibition has failed. We've been at it for 80 years. We tried it with alcohol. When are we going to learn? And I'm I don't have the answer to heroin addiction, and it's a big problem in Baltimore. But what we can do is say, look, I don't want people to die from it. I don't want people to shoot each other over it. To me, that would be a huge victory. It wouldn't solve everything. But let's try something else. Why do we keep doing the same thing that fails year after year after year?
Why, indeed?
It looks like I'm preaching to the choir here.
Because it's very profitable. It's profitable to the people who deal in it. It's profitable to the people who fight it.
But there are a lot of good people who support the war on drugs because I don't think they understand that a lot of the problems, yes, drugs cause problems, but there are even more problems from the war on drugs. And that's something I try to make clear. We can make that distinction and say, yeah, if someone is an addict, that's a drug problem. But if a guy shoots each other on the corner, that's a problem with the war on drugs.
And as you point out, law enforcement can't reduce supply or demand.
We invaded Afghanistan, and there are more drugs coming out of there than ever. Prisons Oops. Have drug problems. Yeah, sorry about that, guys. Yeah. We can't. Every supply reduction doesn't work. Drug prices are cheaper than ever. There are better ways. We could do this. We could do this without the crime. We could follow some of the Dutch example of what they do with legal marijuana. Fewer people die. Fewer people try drugs. That's also people's fear. If you legalize drugs, everyone's going to start taking them. We don't know. We haven't tried it. But other places that have done similar policies, drug usage rates don't go up. People take or don't take drugs for a lot of reasons, but the law isn't one of them.
And the ones who are the most reckless in their addictions die quickly. Seriously, if you studied Needle Park, the experience with Needle Park, what was that in Switzerland?
In Switzerland, which failed. I mean, then they try something new.
It succeeded in the sense that a lot of the worst killed themselves with drugs, so that took care of them. There are those who say the crack epidemic waned because of its lethality, and that makes sense.
I think it waned because I think a younger generation saw that being a crack addict wasn't sexy.
Because their brothers and older contemporaries were dying from it.
But there's a belief among police, too, that, well, you know, if they're all just going to shoot each other, they can clean themselves up that way. It doesn't work. I mean, people continue to overdose. People continue to die and murder, and things aren't better. But, yeah, there is something where... But the point, crack waned not because of the war on drug. It waned because people stopped taking it.
Yeah, well, I know. Because the example was there that this...
Fewer people smoke cigarettes now than 30 years ago.
By far. Here is Bob. Hello, Bob. You're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering what Peter found as far as the chaplaincy for the Baltimore City Police Department, whether it was a good thing, bad thing, or just was there and
a chaplain, you say?
The chaplaincy that they have for the Baltimore Police Department.
I don't know about it, meaning a Baltimore police chaplain, right? Religious, we're talking.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was not a part of my policing at all.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, that was an unusual question, wasn't it?
Well, he was a Baltimore police chaplain. I do know that.
Yeah, but you never ran across him. The Netherlands is a good example as far as you're concerned, because drug addiction there is considered a health problem. Well, it's been medicalized everywhere now.
Yeah, but it's not just all for the drug addicts. Since World War II, there have been 5 police officers killed in Amsterdam. It's a city of about 800,000 people. 5 since World War II. And Baltimore, I don't even want to hazard a guess what it was, but there were 5 died on duty when I was here.
Mm-hmm.
Things don't have to be so violent. What's strange is the drugs are, at the time, under Clinton, Bill Clinton, went to Amsterdam and took some photo ops and said it's an unmitigated failure, their drug policy. And he just made that up. It's not. It works. It's not perfect, and they keep changing it and fixing it.
Right, but from a political point of view...
It's a failure because it showed that prohibition's a failure. That was.
But from a political point of view, he would have been in trouble if he had said, you know, this isn't a bad idea. So you have to view his statement in the context of who he is and who he was.
Yeah, so when are we going to get a politician who is willing to...
Well, to buck public opinion? Let me ask you this, Peter.
Look, the comments on that U.S. News and Report thing, they're 90%. Of course, maybe people on drugs like writing posts. I don't know. But they're all in support of drug legalization and regulation.
No. The commenters may be, okay, to your piece.
Which,
by the way, we've linked to.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Listeners, at WBAL.com. just click on my name, scroll down, and you'll see Peter's.
You guys are good here.
Article. We've got to stay on top of things, you know. But if it were the case that the general public was in favor of drug legalization, you would have no shortage of politicians out there to lead the charge. Believe me, they'd be out there saying, "Doggone it and dagnabbit, we've got to legalize these things," because so that doesn't exist.
Well, that's why we got to frame
it. Yours was a non-scientific sample.
Absolutely. You're right. That's why we got to frame the argument a bit way so people understand it, the problem, to break it down between drug abuse and buying. And to me, it's the problem with drugs, the biggest problem with drugs are public drug dealers, especially in a city like Baltimore. If we could get rid of that, a lot else would fall into place. We'd still have junkies roaming the streets, and I don't got the answer. I don't know if anybody does.
Right.
But we can make a lot of things better.